Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, countdown to the 2012 Paralympic Games. Britain's ambassador to the Holy See shares his hopes for the legacy of London's Olympic experience. The vision and spirit of English sister Mary Ward, four centuries on. We hear from a Loreto sister working with trafficked women and children in Albania. And as we prepare to mark the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, former Archbishop of Westminster, takes us back to the atmosphere and expectations ahead of that great moment in the modern history of the Church. With just under 100 days to go before the opening of the Paralympics in London on August the 29th, disabled athletes in countries around the world are preparing to compete in the 21 different sporting disciplines. Paralympic flames will be lit in England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland over the preceding days, after which teams of torchbearers will converge on the Olympic Stadium in London for the opening ceremony of the 2012 Paralympic Games. The London Games mark a homecoming of sorts for an event which traces its origins to a sporting competition for disabled World War II veterans in England in 1948, coinciding with the opening day of the Summer Olympics in London that year.
We're very proud that the Paralympics, in a sense, are coming back to where it all started, back in 1948.
Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Nigel Baker, told me more about the history of the Paralympics event and the lasting legacy of these 2012 London Games.
The first disability sport competition, it wasn't the Olympics at the time, but was held by Dr. Ludwig Guttmann, who was treating World War II veterans who'd suffered various disabilities, various injuries. It was an archery competition, actually. That was in 1948 at Stoke Mandeville Hospital in Britain. 4 years later, he added Dutch disabled athletes. And then, in a sense, from there, the concept of Paralympic movement, Paralympic Games, in parallel to the Olympic Games, really took off. It was actually the Rome Olympics in 1960, where it was formally for the first time called the Paralympics, over 400 competitors taking part then. And London 2012, you can see how the movement has grown. We're expecting over 4,000 athletes competing in over 20 different sports, 15 different venues, and expecting 2 million people to come and watch the events. The key thing from our point of view is for the first time, London 2012, the Olympics and the Paralympics are completely integrated. It's not as if the Paralympics are an add-on to the Olympics. They're absolutely part of the whole London 2012 experience.
It was an incredibly creative and incredibly bold idea, wasn't it, back in 1948, to see disability as something to celebrate instead of seeing it, as it was so often considered in the past, as a stigma, as some kind of serious problem, to really celebrate the achievements.
And that's really part of what we're trying to do with London 2012 as well. I mean, in a sense, going beyond that celebration, we think that the United Kingdom is a world leader in the way we respond in society and in government to disability, that allowing people to be integrated as far as possible in the normal day-to-day life, and to encourage other people to look at disability not as a problem to be surmounted, but as something that is quite normal in daily life and needs to be integrated. And therefore, the whole focus of the Olympics this year, and I say the Olympics and as well as the Paralympics, will be that accessibility, the London Games will be the most accessible, I think, of any Olympic Games in terms of transport getting there. Disabled people will be part not just of the competition in the Paralympics, but the whole organisation. We have thousands of Olympic volunteers, for example, for the Olympics and Paralympic Games. Many of those volunteers are going to be disabled people who have volunteered and will be able to be part of that. transport systems have been altered to enable people to get to the games easily. My understanding is that even the sort of official Olympic cars are being adapted so that some of the drivers of athletes to the games will be disabled people. And it's also about legacy. Legacy is a critical word of the London Olympics. You know, what comes after? It's not just the big event, but there will be housing, there will be homes, there will be schools that will be part of the London legacy. The importance of sport to society, and also a legacy in terms of disabled people. That's international as well as national. There are a number of countries in the world, off the top of my head, I know in Azerbaijan and in Jordan, for example, where there have been events related to Paralympics. Very often young disabled sportsmen and sportswomen, girls and boys, have been taking part in events as part of the lead up to the games, sort of reminding people that that disabled people should play a full part in life wherever they are.
This point about legacy is very important, isn't it? Because inevitably there has been criticism about the costs, about the disruption to life of local people. How well do you think perhaps those criticisms are being answered?
And cost is always a big thing around any Olympic Games. I mean, the public, the amount of money coming from the public sector for these games in London would be about over £9 billion. So it's costing a lot of money. But I think we're fairly confident that what the Olympics will both create, generating for the UK itself in terms of employment, in terms of the most spectacular infrastructure, regeneration of the post-industrial part of London.
The
East End of London. I'm told that 75 pence in every pound is going into regeneration, essentially. So this is long-term guarantees for the future. So I think, you know, these criticisms are being answered. There will be thousands of people who will come to London, get to London for the first time. So there'll be tourists there, there'll be visitors. And it's about so much more than just sport. We have cultural Olympics as well going on, a great sort of cultural festival. Different parts of society are participating, so using the games as a backdrop. The Catholic Church, for example, in Britain, and other religious denominations are working hard with an initiative called More Than Gold to use the backdrop of the games to emphasise positive aspects of young people being together, of working together, of volunteering, etc. So there's a huge amount going on, far more than sport, even if sport is right at the centre. And I think most people believe that the investment is worthwhile. And we're on budget.
That's always good to hear. You're talking about so many people coming to London. Of course, the other big concern is security, isn't it? As often happens in any event where you have those sort of numbers of people, it's obviously an attraction for the terrorists.
Security is, of course, a massive and prime concern. It is one of the major issues, sadly, one of the major issues that any bidding city has to consider when making its bid to the Olympic Games. We are obviously doing everything that we can to ensure that these games will be absolutely safe and secure for all participants, for all visitors. There has been sort of a bit of controversy recently over some of the more sort of what I would call more dramatic measures being taken, which actually have been taken at other Olympic Games before, such as positioning anti-aircraft missiles near the site and that sort of thing. But these are all standard measures. Our security services, the police, have a lot of experience, and our aim, of course, is to make sure that security doesn't get in the way of people's enjoyment of the games, but facilitates and helps people enjoyment of the games, and of course keep people safe and secure while they're in London.
You mentioned the More Than Gold initiative. Of course, the churches are very involved in many different aspects of the games, and it's a broad ecumenical movement, this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Catholic Church in England and Wales are playing a particularly strong role in this, working alongside, you know, the Anglican Church in parishes across the country, not just in London, and as you say, with other religious groups, with Muslim groups, with Hindu groups. One of the exciting things, I think, about having Olympic Games in London is that London is a world city. If you look at all the countries taking part, most actually will have their own support group amongst their own national community within London. So all kind of, most countries have got their own inbuilt support locally. This obviously extends to religion as well. And we believe that sort of Britain's makeup, multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, will provide a very sort of welcoming and supportive backdrop to this extraordinary international event.
My thanks there to Nigel Baker, Britain's ambassador to the Holy See. The trafficking of women and children for cheap labour or the sex industry is sadly never far away from the news headlines. People trafficking has been identified by the UN as the second most profitable worldwide criminal enterprise after the illegal arms trade. And around 2.5 million people are believed to be in the hands of traffickers in countries right around the world. Within the church, and especially among female religious congregations, there's been a growing response to this worldwide problem, with sisters working in all areas of prevention, support and reintegration of trafficked victims. IBVM Loreto sister Imelda Poole worked for many years among poor and marginalised families in her native north of England before answering a call from her community to travel to Albania and work with the vulnerable and victims of trafficking in the post-communist country.
The problem in Albania in terms of trafficked women and children mainly is a very big one. It is still a very big one. I think primarily internally are the young people being trafficked. Probably 60% of the victims are internally and domestically used for the sex tourism and for sex, the sex industry via the internet, on the streets, or in private accommodation. The children, it's a massive, massive problem of child labour and trafficking to Greece for begging, for what you call illegal work in Tirana itself. Often, very sadly, the poverty leads the girls maybe to become prostitutes, some of the girls, and the traffickers are there very fast with blackmailing about abusing their families. They will tell their families, they will threaten their families, and they're trafficked from prostitution.
It's difficult, it's dangerous work, I imagine, for some of those who are trying to stop these rings, these trafficking rings.
Yes, I mean, anybody working in trafficking, in the work of anti-trafficking, know that there is a potential danger. So you really need to look at how you protect yourself and how you work carefully and privately and secretly. Often the shelters are not known. Where I go to work in the shelter run by the NGO Different and Equal, in fact, nobody knows. We all take a sort of contract of secrecy. It's in a very hidden part of Tirana. Also, I think that, you know, like when I was asked by the church to be involved in the rescue of a victim that had come to their door at the cathedral in Tirana, the girl herself said to me, and I got to realise she was from a very big mafia family, and there was a terrible case of exploitation. And she said herself to me, "Don't come near the taxi where I'm going to get in, because you are being watched by just helping me." So there's a whole sort of risk there. But in fact, you don't really, when you are working in this field, you do it because you have a passion for it, for the justice and for the rightness of it.
Headway do you feel that you are making? As you say, the problem in Albania and in many other countries remains enormous despite growing awareness of the problem.
I think that in terms of really amelioration of the situation of the poor is probably the first task, and that's systemic change. But systemic change can only take place when the government is upright and where there's no corruption. So there's a lot of work to be done in Albania for real change to take place. But I think that education is, of course, a very important aspect for real change. And I think also that if you were to look at the whole question of national referral mechanisms against trafficking, Albania has, in fact, probably got one of the best models in the world. So in writing, the potential for change in Albania is massive. It's very, very hopeful. But when law is not implemented, that's when you know there can be a despairing experience of the people who live in a country, because they see all around them so many laws being made that are good laws, like there's a law against child begging, but every street in Tirana there are children begging, or they're being used for child labour. Because nobody's going to take them up. Because when I talked to a policeman about why not, he said, well, where's the money to implement the law? What do we do with the child? There's no process. So the child is left begging, or the child is left doing illegal labour.
Many of these children, many of these people who are being exploited come from the most vulnerable sections of society, don't they? You mentioned particularly the Roma communities.
Yes, the Roma community, there were about 60,000 in Tirana and in other parts of Albania. They are the most vulnerable because they are not indigenous people of Albania. They're an ethnic minority. And so far, the government has not opted to really support the rehabilitation of these huge numbers of Roma families who live on squat land in camps with no water, no electricity, often not registered because of the system of registration in Albania, many without an education. So our congregation made the decision to open a project for a particular area of Tirana where there was nobody supporting the Roma community. And that led us to open a school. We've employed all Albanian people to run this project, and I work with them in terms of ethical behaviour, in terms of developmental progress and so on. And there's a lot of really good news like this. So when you say about progress, well, I think that, you know, when a child learns to read and write, you've got progress. When a traffic victim is able to get a job and to move on, there's progress. In our women's project, Women's Rights in Albania for Justice, Freedom and to Speak a Truth, which was founded in honour of Mary Ward, our foundress, whose 400th anniversary it was this last 2 years, then, you know, you're beginning to look at systemic change, because you're working with women who are the most vulnerable in the informal and the rural regions of Albania, and you're working to see them grow. And I'm just thrilled, actually, after 3 years, to see, you know, these women of Lach, say, who were mostly prostitutes, mostly abandoned by the city, but now, you know, with a bit of training and lots of comings together socially and so on, you know, they're being to say, who'd have believed we could have done this 3 years ago? Who would have believed we'd be, our husbands wouldn't have let us, or our partners or whoever wouldn't have let us? Who would have believed we'd open a little shop and so on? So, you know, you do see little pockets of hope, and I think that gives you the will and the passion to keep going, because it's little by little by little.
What do you think are the keys to this kind of rehabilitation you're talking about? Because these women have been deeply scarred and traumatised, haven't they? Often beaten physically.
We believe that the key to it is group formation, that alone they can't do anything because they're too frightened. Actually, they've been taught to be hopeless by life. So on their own, they are that way. But together, little by little, they can begin to hear another woman's little bit of hope, and that gives them a little bit of hope. So our first initiative for at least a year was to develop and build groups in 17 regions of Albania. And that I think, has been the key to the success, is group formation and group strength and the network from that.
Albania is, of course, a majority Muslim country. Mm. How much is there a religious component in this work that you're doing? Mm.
I personally believe that where you build the human dignity, you are at the coalface of faith. And Jesus himself said, love your neighbour as yourself. So how can anybody even begin to love their neighbour, never mind God, if they have no love of themselves and no self-esteem, and they've even been told they're useless and hopeless? So I think that My absolutely fundamental belief is that give a person human dignity and you give them an opportunity to touch love. And touching love, they find God. So there is that, what I would call, a sort of way to God through love. And that in that loving, that passionate love of God, which is deeply in my heart, I just believe that the fire of it just got to overflow and to others. And I'm amazed how many of the victims talk to me about God. Just the other week, we had two new ones, and they happened to be Catholics. And when they heard I was a Catholic, and they began to jump up and down because they thought they might have hope to go back to church, maybe to find some inspiration that they remembered from their mum and dads before all this happened. But, you know, when you talk about the Muslim tradition, truly, you know, I find whoever that you're with in Albania, they are thirsting for God. And frequently, in all different walks of life, it will come up, you know, about this whole thing of how do you get hope, how do you sustain life, and who is God and where is God, and how do you find God. So it's just being there and allowing God's work to work. Because I actually really, really believe that this, whatever I'm in, is controlled by God and is the mission of God, and that God is working whether I'm there or not, and therefore faith development will happen with that spark, and that everybody's got the opportunity. I just do believe that.
My thanks there to Sister Imelda Poole of the Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary, founded by Mary Ward 4 centuries ago. Later this year, the Church will be officially marking the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council on October the 11th, 1962. That three-year historic meeting of bishops, which set a course for the Church in the modern world, will be celebrated in many ways in countries right around the globe, in particular here in the Vatican, as bishops gather once again this October for a synod on the need for new evangelization to promote the gospel message half a century on from that landmark Council. Today, though, I'd like to step back in time to that moment just as the Council was about to begin, and I'm going to do that thanks to the memory of Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, former Archbishop of Westminster and longtime expert in the ecumenical dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Anglican Communion. The Cardinal talked to me about the expectations and the legacy of Vatican II, beginning with his recollections of the excitement in the air ahead of the opening of the Council in the autumn of 1962.
Well, I was an assistant priest at the time in Portsmouth, but I do remember being very excited by the prospect of the Council and the wonderful Pope John, who captivated the world, really, with his humility and naturalness and humour, and his taking the very brave step of having a council. I mean, from all my studies, you know, councils happen every few hundred years, so this was something not only significant, but something very exciting. We really didn't know what was going to occur. And so I followed the council very closely, especially the four great documents on liturgy and the Church, and Revelation. And of course, when I became a bishop, I took as my motto, Gaudium et Spes, the Church and the modern world.
Why were you particularly attracted to that document, to that particular theme, if you like?
Well, because I thought that, speaking in a way simplistically, that the Council brought both a great deal of joy to people and a new approach of the Catholic Church to the world in which we live, and also hope for people. That I always thought hope one of the theological virtues, which is not understood enough. You know about faith, and we know about charity, but hope is something. It brings meaning to life. So I thought, then, and if we talk about the Council, then yes, it did bring a lot of joy, and also hope for the future.
What effects did it have directly on the Church in England, as you remember it, in the weeks, the months, the years after the Council?
I suppose the most immediate effect was the liturgy, especially, obviously, the change in the language from Latin to English, and the sense in which there was a genuine participation of lay people, and the mystery of the liturgy, the Mass in particular, was opened up for people in a new way. So I think that was the first effect. And then other things, it took longer to understand, I mean, especially the document on the church, which talked about the people of God, and the church, which was not just about hierarchy, it was about mystery, it was about communio, communion. And then, of course, for me, when the document on ecumenism came out, which was really a follow-up to the document on the church, well, I read that avidly, really, and I remember the words, which indeed, years ago, I more or less learnt by heart. There's no ecumenism worthy of the name without interior conversion, newness of attitudes, and unstinted love. And I've taken that as my kind of motto, newness of attitudes, you know, to look on our fellow Christians as people with whom we share such a lot. Newness of attitude, conversion of heart, because we used to kind of suspect them, you know, and we grew up, well, the Catholic Church was it. The Protestant Church, whatever its form, was not it. But now we were encouraged to pray together, to be together, to try and grow in communion together. And that was a great change. And unstinted love, and actually to be friends with our fellow Christians, and in as much as we're able to witness together. And that affected me then very, very much. I was by that time working with one of the bishops, or Archbishop Warlock, as his secretary, as his chaplain. And so I had to deal with that at first hand.
He was a great ecumenist, of course, himself, wasn't he?
Well, he was. I mean, when he left, I was with him when he was Bishop of Portsmouth, but particularly when we went to Liverpool, he and Bishop David Shepherd, the Anglican bishop, they were a great partnership. Now, that's the sort of thing that should be happening everywhere. And I must say that the effect of the council with regard to inter-church relations, especially in England with the Anglicans, despite the theological difficulties, which are very real, I think the friendship and the growing awareness that we must witness together in so many fields, especially in an increasing secular society, that's been very important.
My thanks there to the former Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor. And you can hear more of that interview on his memories and the legacy of the Second Vatican Council on this programme at the same time next week. For now, that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.